We'll try and get the right subject today. Raymond Lully, who was one of the great early alchemists, once pointed out that the great tragedy of the concept of alchemy was the transmutation of metals. Basil Valentine, monk of St. Benet, had the same thought when he wrote into one of his books, "Woe to the gold makers." Now, this is an interesting thought because our subject this morning, essentially, is esoteric alchemy. And the history of alchemy itself divides into two distinct branches that have descended from antiquity, possibly originating in Egypt. The word chem in both chemistry and alchemy is an ancient name for Egypt. El is divine or sacred, and we find it used in the Bible in such terms as Elohim, and of course the deity of Islam is Allah. The divine prefix would indicate that alchemy is a spiritual art, a divine secret science. The great texts of alchemy have come principally from the Hermetic background at the beginning of the Christian era. And probably there were alchemical schools in Alexandria at that time. Also, we have early records of alchemy in China and in India. And it seems that from a very far back, there has descended a double concept of chemistry. Physical chemistry having to do with those areas of knowledge which are now considered scientific, and spiritual chemistry, which was definitely a sacred art. In practice, what is the difference in these two systems? I think probably Paracelsus summarized this rather well when he pointed out that the alchemical transmutation was impossible unless the alchemist himself was in the process of transformation. He could not sit back with his bottles and test tubes and retorts and consider his art simply another way of advancing chemistry or a way of replenishing his own financial needs. So we find, as is today, that chemistry is largely dominated with the profit concept, the idea of wealth. We are making all kinds of chemical experiments for various reasons, some of them very good, some of them very dangerous, but always with a certain concept of return in material wealth for the good or the evil that is done. So that largely chemistry is a material art dominated by scientific inquiry and not in any way involving any necessary spiritual overtones. The chemist does not have to be a person of great faith. He does not have to have had a metaphysical experience. He does not need to believe in metaphysical or mystical procedures. He is simply working with physical tests and physical texts. The alchemist, on the other hand, is an entirely different type of person. In the history of alchemy, as it is descending to us, most of the alchemists were very pious people, deeply religious, and convinced that their advancement of science was a spiritual contribution to the well-being of society. The alchemist was concerned with the advancement of his own inner life. Jacob Behme used a number of alchemical terms in his mystical writings, and these have been very confusing to modern students of his work. But actually, the use given by Behme in most cases is probably the original intended usage, namely that it is all part of a great system of human regeneration, that it has nothing to do whatsoever with the advancement of worldly goods or worldly position. Now, in Europe, the alchemists got into trouble, very serious trouble, and were persecuted and in many cases put to the rack and tortured to death. Why? Because the rulers or avaricious leaders wanted the secret of gold making. So the moment the alchemist himself began to publicize this part of his belief, he immediately opened himself to persecution. So that the gold making as a science brought many of the alchemists to destruction. Also, the manufacture of gold or any other precious substance without control by the state could result in the bankruptcy of the world. So the ancients were very careful on that point. Now, the question then remains is, can gold be actually manufactured? Not whether it should be or not, but can it be? I think the answer has to be in the affirmative. It can be. It also is obvious from recent experimentation that the subject could be advanced, and in the course of time, it is probable that artificial metals can be created by chemistry and by the various forms of progress that we now have in the sciences. But this is not the real purpose of alchemy. And where the chemists all get together to raise their own level of economic living, the science went into a very desperate prostitution. It was not for that purpose at all. The earliest alchemists that we know were using symbols at a very early date. Many cases, the symbols have been accepted as literal pictures, and this has led to further confusion. We know, for instance, that in ancient alchemy, the great retort in which all the experiments were being made was the solar system itself, viewed as a globe within which all the chemistries and alchemies of existence were taking place. We know from our own researches in more recent times, and the ancients certainly believed, that this world in which we live is a great theater of mysteries, the major secrets of which have never been solved. That actually the world is a strangely complete thing within itself, containing everything necessary for the infinite perpetuation of itself. And this condition goes on rather peacefully and naturally until human ambition and avarice take over. The ambition of the average modern person is involving fame, distinction, or wealth. Therefore, he immediately is using knowledge for the formation, directly or indirectly, of gold. He may not make the gold in the retort, but he will sell secrets or sell scientific developments which will bring him rich financial rewards. Now we might say, what harm is this? Well, one of the reasons why it is extremely dangerous is because the moment we begin to experiment with the basic laws of existence, we are very apt to forget their own integrities. Natural laws have to be obeyed, and modern thinking is not of the obeying type. We are not interested in obeying natural laws. We are interested in changing them to fit our conveniences. We want to use natural law to exploit the universe in which we live. And as a result of that, we are constantly in trouble and are in the same dilemma that burdens the alchemist. Many years ago, we had an amateur alchemist here in Los Angeles. He was a delightful old German gentleman, and for a prosaic living, he worked in a cheese factory. Now, he wasn't hoping to transform cheese into gold or anything of that nature. But he was experimenting on the side throughout most of his life, trying to work out these strange and mysterious formulas that had descended to him from the past. Before his passing on, by the way, which occurred many years ago, he gave most of his alchemical books to our library. But he passed on definitely certain that there was an answer, but that he had not been able to live long enough to find it. Then we had another gentleman who was engaged in alchemical speculation. He followed every rule in the book that he could find, and of course soon found that every book had a different set of rules. This is always confusing and very frustrating. He went on and on and on, using every contrivance of physical knowledge. He bought a lot of apparatus and instruments. He followed hunches and hints, and he kept on going, and he was always on the verge of a great discovery, but it never happened. The one thing that he did not do, as I tried to point out to him on a number of occasions, he did not have a deep, abiding love of God, faith, or mankind. He was simply an intellectual, convinced that a science could be made to work. But what the science meant in terms of his own character never seemed to occur to him. Now, when we go into the alchemy of China and India, we find almost immediately that the symbolism moves from pure chemistry and things of that matter to all kinds of vibratory patterns which we know in life. Alchemy in China was tied in with music and the musical scale, the harmonics of life. The ancient Greeks of the Pythagorean period combined all their knowledge of cosmogony and the actual reformation of man into a great mathematical formula, which was never to be taken literally, but was to become almost like a mantra, a sacred statement, which if obeyed could produce tremendous results. Also, as we went along through the different systems, we find that Hermetic philosophy became involved in alchemy. The Hermetists of Alexandria followed a mysterious being known to them as Hermes Trismegistus, Hermes the thrice greatest. Who he was, when he lived, no one seems to know. Whether he was a production of symbolism or perhaps a great alchemical adept of some ancient time, we do not know. But in Hermeticism, we begin to sense the beginning of the transmutation of man as the essential purpose of the great alchemical procedure. In Europe, of course, it was necessary to be more careful in the promulgation of some of these beliefs because of the bitter opposition of the clergy. The clergy sensed the fact that in some way alchemy was a religion, and they were therefore quite sure it had to be included among the heresies. As a result, however, of the motion of Arabic knowledge into Europe, the alchemical secrets passed to keeping of persons like Paracelsus and Kunroth and Valentine, and these persons gained their knowledge of the alchemical processes largely from Constantinople and Baghdad. This, of course, meant still more that it had to be held in secrecy against the persecutions and martyrdoms that were popular at that time in Europe. So we find alchemy in many parts of the world recognized probably for what it actually was, and that is a series of symbols intended to convey a major operation concerning the transmutation of man himself. Without this transmutation, none of the great good things that we dream of can come about. Therefore, the elixir of life, or the philosopher's stone, was that power by means of which all good things could come to pass, wherein all errors and forms of ignorance could be overcome, and where the human being himself would gain complete control of not only his own life, but the laws governing it. Therefore, we come to this particular thought that seems to be very much in the medieval alchemical tradition, and that is there any proof of transmutation? Do we have any actual evidence of things being completely altered? Has there ever been a scientist that could completely alter anything? He could modify it, yes. He could improve it to a degree. He could destroy it always. But the process of actual transformation of a thing from what it is to something totally different. This was been a question that has been of concern in alchemical researches for ages. The answer, of course, is extraordinarily simple. The answer lies in the human body itself. The process of digestion of food requires the transformation of elements. It requires an almost instantaneous adaptation of certain principles to special usages for which they were not originally intended. It is possible, therefore, for food which is taken in to in some way maintain a life principle, which is not the food, which is not in the body otherwise, but it must be used to nourish the spiritual ends or principle in the human being. Therefore, the bread and butter and the cheese and milk keep alive something that is not any of them. Keep alive a thing which throughout life will continue to cause the heart to beat, which will continue to circulate the blood and nourish the functions of the human being until the end of life. Therefore, out of what goes into him, comes out of him arts and sciences, poetry and music, philosophy and science, religion and economics. They all come out of someone, and that someone is nourished by the food, by the atmosphere around him, by water, and by the rays of the planets and the light of the sun and moon. Therefore, the wedding of the sun and moon in alchemy is very important. Not because we're going to have a wedding up in the sky of the two luminaries, but because we're going to have a union of the principles for which they stand inside of the human body itself. So we have the amazing recognition that one life flowing behind all forms and made available through nutrition to every living creature. We find, consequently, that from the harvests in the fields, that a world is nourished, and those who eat these harvests become proficient in many forms of activity. Now, this, in a sense, is a problem that we find in the Christian doctrine of the Eucharist. Here we have a problem of the divine blood. And in alchemy, this divine blood is the elixir of life. How this divine blood operates is not clear to many people. But in some mysterious way, universal life supports living things. And these living things may never be aware of the source of their own nutrition. And in a mechanistic era such as ours, they do not care about the source of their nutrition. All they want is to keep on going. Now, out of all this has come a new concept of nutrition also, a concept involving vitamins and proteins and carbohydrates, an entire system of nutrition based upon the development of highly specialized nutrients from the various food materials that we eat. That all these food things have something to do with the maintenance of the various structures of the human body. In this sense of the word, there is an acceptance of alchemy without any understanding of it. Here we have the realization that nutrition does do the work. But how this nutrition does it, and why it does it, and how one general type of nutrition can maintain an infinite diversity of creatures is another problem that is difficult to understand. One of the problems, of course, is that the nutrition must be regarded as conditioned to the creature which is receiving the nourishment. So we have within our own bodies an extraordinary laboratory, a laboratory the mysteries of which we haven't begun to touch. A laboratory in which every type of nutrient is made available to every type of living thing. And all this happens without a chemist sitting somewhere and arranging it all. We can, in nutrition, have someone who can help to make it practical, who can prescribe various materials for our common nutrition and for special emergencies that arise. But prescribing them is not creating them, and prescribing them is not understanding them. It is simply that we have gradually come to know that certain materials have certain effects, and we depend upon this to maintain the procedures which we hope will strengthen and lengthen our life expectancies. Now, immortal life was one of the beliefs of alchemy. So they had a number of very quaint and unusual concepts about this matter. Some of these concepts are very difficult to understand even now. But we know that they definitely believed that there were in the world a few individuals who had solved the mystery of alchemy. And the master of all the alchemists was Elias Atista, the most celebrated of all the Hermetic adepts and philosophers. No one really knew him, although we do have two or three early books in the library in which alchemists describe a meeting with him. But Elias Atista was the symbol of the perfect alchemist. He had a number of disciples, however, who came very close to him in achieving the ends which he sought. And the powers of Elias were such that he would appear in laboratories where worthy persons had worked very hard for years and given them a hint or a little advice to advance their researches. Then he disappeared and was never seen by them again. He appeared in many nations and in many different appearances. He spoke many languages. But he is supposed to be an eternal person, living on and on, because there was nothing within himself to cause him to die. Death has to be the result of causes. And life expectancies are increasing constantly. But life expectancies to reach phenomenal extension of time are now either a phenomenon in themselves, or else they are the result of very serious scientific conditioning or constitutional ability to adapt nutrition over a longer period of time than is possible to most people. The alchemists also pointed out that the beginning of the alchemical experiment was, of course, to remove all friction from life. By friction, we mean wear and tear. Now, what is wear and tear? Well, to most people, wear and tear is doing the things they have to do and have no particular interest in doing. Wear and tear is also the result of the lack of control of the mental, emotional, and physical activities of the individual. All of these activities use energy. A large part of the energy we use today we waste. We are not conserving it. We are not taking care of this mysterious vitality that comes to us. We are allowing it to be expended in all kinds of useless ways. Of course, we have to make physical adjustments for employment and things of this nature. But at the same time, it isn't the work necessarily that is the greatest cause of problem. It is the attitude toward the work. It is the lack of enthusiasm, the lack of recognition of significance of the things that we do that depresses. Then emotional relationships out of hand can become a terrible enemy to vitality. Worry, fear, anxiety, all of these use up part of this alchemical nutrition that is constantly being made within ourselves. If we waste it, we can no longer have it. If we use it unwisely, it is dissipated. And gradually, to keep on with the artificial attitudes that we have, we undermine the necessary functions of the body. So the alchemists, first of all, declared that the master of all arts was God. Deity was, in a sense, the extra-personal, perfect alchemist. because in deity all things continue according to the divine will. How this will operates, man does not know exactly. But he does recognize, if he is mystically inclined, that there is a tremendous background of eternal wisdom behind the things that happen in nature. And so deity becomes the perfect force behind generation and regeneration. The deity brings forth the seed, the plant, the flower, and the fruit. And then that seed becomes the next generation of the same. And in alchemy, these seeds are called the tears of God, because they are the weepings which produce life everywhere. The symbolism is strange and obscure, but we can gradually work some of it into a pattern if we try hard enough. We just begin with what the alchemist begins with, base metals. We must begin with things as they are here, visibly and inevitably. We cannot build our alchemical formulas from elements or substances not available to us. So the beginning of all things is to recognize that the first operation is a transmutation of physical factors, elements, and properties. In other words, purification. If it's mercury, it must be purified. If it is sulfur, it must be purified. If it is salt, it must be purified. And if it is man, he must be purified. Everything begins with the purification or the removal of the dross, which limits the value and limits the survival of elements, principles, and substances. So we start with the concept of a pure material with which to work. The alchemist is given various clues and keys on how to achieve this pure material. He might assemble it under certain aspects of planets. He might wait until the moon shines upon the water before he uses it in his test tubes. He may do all kinds of things. He must purify, first of all, by gathering his materials from pure sources as much as he can. Most of the great experiments of Paracelsus and many others were possible because of the pure, high atmosphere of the Alps. Here, materials were uncontaminated. Here, things grew to the fullness of themselves. And here, in his day, there was no smog or congestion. This pure materials, having been found, become the basic elements with which to work. Now, you may have to go out and work and look and search for a long time to find a pure material in workable condition, something that you can actually use. Now, the same problem applies to the person himself. The alchemist must first purify his own body and his own nature. Until the body is cleansed, its various processes cannot be refined. Because actually, all the purification in man, all the integration and organization of his abilities and capacities, all the improvement of his nature through learning, through meditation, and through contemplation, all of these things lead up to, contribute to, and make possible a final internal illumination. The final secret has to come from inside. Therefore, everything has to be refined until the soul of itself is available. And in man, it is his own soul. And until this is available, he labors in vain. Now, the things that have to contribute to this progress must be considered as disciplines or as first steps toward achievement. They represent, first of all, man's recognition of his responsibility to the life principle which exists in him and in which he exists. This principle is divine, sacred, and the most valuable and mysterious thing in the whole world. Unless the individual is true to this basic principle in his own life and his own way of living and thinking, he cannot hope to advance in the cause of spiritual alchemy. So he must do everything possible to make his own life reasonable and normal. Now, this doesn't mean that he has to depart from society or go into some refuge on the top of the Alps. It means, however, that there must be an establishment of basic harmony within himself. Harmony is the proof of the compatibility of the elements. Harmony is the ability of different chemical elements to work together. And this is only possible when they are purified, for in their gross form they will never be compatible. Salt and sulfur in the form of the physical elements that we can buy in a store can never be compatible. Therefore, it is necessary to cleanse them both, refine them, and take out of them those elements or parts which are the cause of conflict. It is not the spirit of sulfur or the spirit of salt that is in trouble. It is the crystallization around it, by means of which it becomes in conflict with other similar crystallizations. This we know, then, is what the ancients believed to be the creation of peace within the self. The alchemist must put his own house in order. He must begin by realizing that he is actually searching for something that is in its substance and essence completely sacred. Before any other consideration is going to damage his probabilities of getting it. Now, the alchemical procedure that is most commonly known is relating to two distinct ends. One is the creation of the philosopher's stone, and the other is the brewing of the philosophical medicine, the elixir of life. So the stone in itself represents the body of wisdom purified, and the universal medicine represents the soul. The medicine of immortality must be derived from things that have a birth and death within themselves. In other words, the nutrition that is given off may cause the primitive element to be lost. But its power goes on. It does not die. It simply reincarnates on a higher level. For when we take into ourselves basic elements, they are reborn in us and therefore pass through a process of evolution as they are used by the human being to maintain the economy of life. So in the beginning, the alchemist must find a quiet place to work. He must have his little laboratory. Well, a laboratory in his day was a furnace, a fireplace, a bunch of bottles, and a few old books to guide his way. But to us, the laboratory is actually a body of soul free from interference and confusion that he can retire into it when he so wills. In other words, the laboratory is his own internal. Not his eternal, but his internal. It is that part of himself which is always capable of being reduced to a harmonious situation. The personal life must be basically harmonious. Now, a lot of people feel that this is not possible. That there is no answer to all these grievances and griefs that beset us and affect us. But the alchemist says, you are after the most valuable thing in the world. And if you are hoping to get it, you must earn it. You must make adjustments that will never be required of anyone except for this purpose. So to create a quiet place within the self for the contemplation of the symbols of regeneration, this is very vital. It does not mean, however, that the person has to become a constant celled monk or mysterious acolyte. He does not have to retire from life. He simply has to retire from confusion. He has to reject the idea of confusion within himself. The acceptance of confusion is a form of ignorance. It is not real, but we all are subject to it. But confusion also means waste of energy, waste of time, depletion, an inability in that state to contact a deeper and higher part of ourselves. This we find in our Oriental philosophies in the series of Yoga and Vedanta. Here we find the mystery of the chakras, and the chakras are the seven seals of Revelation, and the seven seals of Revelation are actually the seven sacred metals of the alchemical transmutation. It's all part of one thing. But if the Orientalist wishes to practice yoga, it is very important for him to first of all recognize that he is not practicing it in order to gain power to dominate somebody else. He is not practicing it in order to free himself from the responsibilities of living. He is practicing it because it is a way ordained by deity, by means of which the wanderer returns home to the spiritual homeland from which he came. It is a part of a journey, and the journey up through the chakras and up through the Sushumna Nadi are all journeys toward reality, toward the self, toward the infinite, which we are all seeking to understand. So in alchemy, the quietude is the same as that recommended for yoga, to find a quiet place. Now, in Tibet, there used to be an old monastery where they had a very nice idea of how to train an acolyte in quietude. They had him sit under the temple bell and rang it all the time until most people would have gone completely crazy. But he was supposed to sit there and be so peaceful that it was incredible. He must reach a point where that clanging meant absolutely nothing, or in which finally he was able to hear in this clanging the voice of God. There had to be a complete indifference to interruption. An indifference which did not mean to neglect duties, but it meant to curb abuses of all kinds. So the alchemist also had to learn to achieve an absolute quietude that was not negative. He was not looking for a psychic revelation. He was simply finding peace, which is the foundation of growth. After a certain length of time in this allotted labor, he was able to quiet his nature, to release from it certain basic powers already available to him. Because he also has within himself the seven seals of Revelation in the forms of the vital organs, the various ductless glands, the various systems of the body, the composition of the blood, and the seven orifices of the heart. And it is in this Shaptapana cave, as Buddha pointed out, of the heart that the great mysteries are revealed. So the heart becomes also part of the alchemical paraphernalia, by means of which the individual receives finally the full support. Also, of course, the alchemists used as a symbol of their achievement the lamb with the cut throat and the blood pouring from it, because of the idea of man being saved by the blood of the lamb. Now, the blood of the lamb in this case is actually the Eucharistic vitality, which arises from the absolute sacrifice of all forms of negation and the purification of the life that flows to us through the wonderful possibilities of the infinite itself. Now, after getting nice and quiet about these things, the body being as much at rest as possible, we soon come to another very important decision. For this purpose, the body can be considered alchemically the power of the moon. And this body being subject to all kinds of digestive and assimilative processes, the lunar energies work for the maintenance constantly of the peace of the flesh. And the individual has to cooperate consciously with this process if he wishes to proceed further. Now, having gotten a little bit of control of the body, we make usually a very disheartening discovery, at least for the beginning. And that is, essentially speaking, the body, which is the earth of the alchemical experiment, didn't really do us very much harm in the first place. It wasn't the flesh, but the dweller in the flesh that was giving trouble nearly always. The flesh was not, it was the victim. The flesh was being scourged daily. It was being constantly like some faithful animal by the ambitious, self-centered driver. So the next thing was to find out what this driving force was. And the moment we do that, we begin to get into the fire principle, which is emotion. Now, emotion is life. The energy behind emotion is magnificent. It's divine. But the use we put to it is miserable in most cases. Emotion is when we get mad, angry, jealous, our ambitions run wild, we don't like people, we don't like things, we can't stand the daily problems of life, and we become beautifully and systematically neurotic. So with all these disagreements within ourselves, our emotions are constantly battling us. If the moment we sit down somewhere, a negative thought floats in, another idea comes along, and always there is this temptation, if I'm going to work this hard, what am I going to get for it? This is one of the major temptations. Those working truly for the good of the great alchemical mystery are not concerned about what they are going to get for it. They are concerned only with the fact that it is the spiritual and moral necessity of their lives, that it is that for which they were intended in the first place. And the only thing they're going to get for it is release from the absence of it, release from the pain and misery of trying to live without it. So the emotional factor, which beats the body, which uses up a very large part of the energy which the body is able to manufacture, is a constant wasting of life. It is a wasting of the divine power. It is the body being perverted and being mismanaged simply because we want to do what we want to do. Now, behind this little mystery and this little problem lies thousands of years of tradition. We have always supposed that when we were unpleasant, we had a right to be. We also believed that when we wanted to think something nasty about a person, it was our privilege. Or if we wanted to be angry and go into warfare, that was also a right that was inalienable. So out of emotional excess on the personal level are all the temper fits and poutings and psychoses that we most dread. And on the larger world field of the great alchemical retort, this misuse of emotional energy is war, crime, and all the difficulties that we most fear.